This is it. If this is it, then please let me know. We wanted some Huey Lewis in the news to start the podcast, but we couldn't get the rights for that. So you're going to have to get used to that music. Days in the making. No, we've been thinking about this for a long time. That's a dive, my first podcast. I've been thinking about doing this for a long time, basically because I can't shut up and can't fit all my thoughts into these tiny windows that we have on live television to talk about some of these amazing storylines, all the things going on in the game, the things you guys are talking about at the bar, at home, at work, all day long. We're thinking about that too, and we want to talk about it here. So the idea of the podcast is every week to grab three topics, the three topics that are buzzing around, the three topics on everyone's mind, the three topics that are causing brothers to not talk to each other and block each other on Instagram and Twitter, and dive into them. Dive in a little bit deeper than you normally get a chance to in interviews or on television, and just let it all out. Let it all out there. And so I've got my amazing partner in crime here, producer Jorge, who's going to try to get me to shut up and move on to the next topic so this doesn't become a four-hour podcast. But also chime in from time to time. Give me some questions. Give me some thoughts. Kind of steer me in other directions if I'm just going around in circles, which I tend to do. But the three I wanted to start with, it's the international break. So Arsene Wenger, do we have any news? What's going on that front? A big decision. Is he going to take his talents to South Beach? What's going on there? So we're going to get into that. Because it was the international break, we're going to be a little U.S. soccer heavy. The second topic is going to be Pulisic, this phenom. But first, the Bruce is loose. Bruce is back. Bruce Arena. And I have to say, I love Bruce. I do. I got a little soft spot in my heart for Bruce Arena. And let me just go back and kind of tell you my history with Bruce Arena. I've known the guy for over 20 years. And I went to University of Virginia. Kenny Arena, Bruce's son, was in my class. He was actually on my recruiting trip. And that's a story that I'm not going to tell on this podcast. But that was quite a night. And we decided to go to UVA. Had a great, fun time there. Amazing opportunity to play soccer with a bunch of guys that I loved. And Bruce Arena was there a lot, there watching his son. And I got to know Bruce. And in the off seasons, I would go stay at the Arena household and train with DC United. And Bruce gave me a couple opportunities when I was a young whippersnapper to train with the first team, too, the national team when he got that job. So I got to know Bruce really, really well as a person. And then in my playing career, Bruce gave me my first cap, gave me my chance with the U.S. soccer team, called my little scrawny butt into the camp with my hair and my shoelace trying to be Ginola or any just amazing European long flowing haired player. Kania, just anyone. I was going for it. Didn't work. And so I loved playing for Bruce because and that's the first thing I want to do is just describe what it is about Bruce that I like as a coach. I love playing for Bruce because he was so clear in what he wanted from you. He was a great communicator. And he won at every level. Won at the college level. Won with DC United. So started at UVA, won there. Wins at DC United, won there. Got with the U.S. team and started winning games. And you respect the winner. And you know that he's going to get the best out of you. He's going to get the best out of the team. And it was clear he had, I think is the most important quality of a manager. He had that gift of seeing you and knowing what made you tick, knowing who to light a fire under, who to put an arm around, all those cliches about a coach. And Bruce, you know, Bruce could say things to you that made you realize, okay, you know what? This guy cares. This guy cares about me. He cares about this team. He wants us to win, and had such a great understanding and a finger on the pulse of what worked in this sort of organic atmosphere of an environment and a unique environment with the U.S. national team because it's different than your club team. Club team, you're there every single day. You know, you see the manager in the hallway every single day. It's kind of like the cute girl you have a crush on in school. You get butterflies in your stomach when you pass them in the hallway, and you know you build up the courage to say hello in the morning, but. It's a daily thing. It's this routine that you get very comfortable with, and it's very repetitious. But national team is different because you only see each other every now and then. So you really have to, like old friends in a high school reunion, catch up really fast. And Bruce was so good at understanding what was working at your club team and translating that to fit you into the national team picture. So his training sessions were quick, they were competitive, they were simple, it was easy to understand. And that kind of gets me on to why he's good for right now, because it's taking over after Jurgen Klinsmann. So Jurgen Klinsmann was the opposite of that. I never played for him, but I talked to guys that were in camps. I went and watched training sessions. And Jurgen's ethos was control everything. Control what you eat, what you watch, when you go to bed, when you meet, when you walk, who you room with, you know, how you sound. I mean, he wanted the whole environment to be so professional and so organized and so regimented that he could measure everything. And then what he would do, which is another thing that was so unlike Bruce, is he would switch things up on you. He'd always have players guessing. You wouldn't know what position you were going to be playing. You didn't know what the lineup was going to be. He did all these things to just make guys uncomfortable, kind of throw them in the water, see if they could swim and test them, because that's what he knew worked in a very cutthroat European environment that he grew up in, that cultivated the world-class player that he was. But Bruce is the opposite. Bruce is about making you comfortable. He wants you to immediately start to empower yourself and connect with the guys. Dinner's on your own. I mean, that's something that you know, Klinsmann would never do. Go out and have dinners on your own. He'd give them freedom. He would empower them to hold each other accountable. He would he would make it very clear who's starting. You know, set up the lineups that week. You know, B team against A team. Who's going to be playing that weekend? You see the guy that's starting that position, and you know what you have to do to beat him to maybe start next game. And the training sessions were so competitive and so. They built towards the weekend. When you got to the game, you knew exactly what the game plan was, what you needed to do. And I think that was one of the major things that started to struggle at the end of the Jurgen Klinsmann era, was he got the credit of, and I understand why, world-class player. You walk into the locker room, everyone, I mean, he was an icon, a complete legend to some of these guys in the locker room. So immediately they want to hear from him. How did you become a world-class player? You know, Germany with Yogi Love, what worked there? I'm here, I'm a sponge, I want to listen. But after a certain while, I think that credit ran out of being that sort of big figure. And then guys were confused. They weren't playing the position they played for their club team, for the national team. You know, there were certain cliques in the locker room. It was just a very, from when I spoke to guys and from what I witnessed, it was so unlike a Bruce Arena locker room. So this kind of regression, I guess you could call it, which is kind of a pejorative term, is really just back to a comfort zone. Bruce is the lazy boy, and Jurgen was sort of the modern Swedish piece of furniture you didn't know how to sit on. And so we've seen the early stage, right? 4 points, 2 World Cup qualifiers, back on track. And it's no surprise that first game against Honduras, it just clicked. We saw 4-4-2 diamond. Everyone knew what they were going to do. Everyone knew their position. They knew their role. You know, he had a bunch of injuries going into that game. Lost a lot of guys before you know, days before that camp even started. The, you know, the Woods and the Jordan Morris and, you know,
Fabian Johnson,
you know, DeAndre Yedlin. I mean, big pieces to the puzzle. And then in camp, from game one to game two, lost a bunch of guys. Mm-hmm. Brooks had to go back home.
Legette.
And Legette, who feels so bad for that guy, yeah. Foot injury. I mean, come on. I know what that feels like. I remember I messed my ankle up, and Bruce invited me in to play at the Confederations Cup, an incredible opportunity, and against Cameroon, I'm having a good game, and I get tackled from behind, bust my ankle up. Next trip, a week later, is Gold Cup, so I had to miss that. That thing derailed me. But I'm not going to feel sorry for myself right now, Jorge. I don't want you to see me cry.
It'll be another topic in the
future
podcast.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll get down to that one. My therapist has heard plenty of that. So it works under Bruce. Mm-hmm. Now, is that the long-term plan? I mean, is that the end goal? I don't think so. I think it's the right goal for right now. Safest pair of hands, most experienced guy in terms of what it takes to get through CONCACAF, get through the Hex, get to a World Cup, try to get out of the group. I mean, that's what you need now. You need to kind of take a step back. As far as, you know, Jurgen Klinsmann was the technical director, and he was the coach. It was so complicated. It was very ambitious. Jurgen came in with this sort of mission statement: I'm going to turn this into a team where we're going to the later stages of World Cups, and we're playing a certain way, toe to toe with these players. But you know what? The high water mark was 2002. I mean, that's what Bruce Arena did in that World Cup, which, by the way, that was a really difficult group. I mean, that was the real Portugal back then. That was Rui Costa. That was Figo. I mean, that was a serious Portugal. Mm-hmm. This last Portugal the U.S. faced, no disrespect, was not that Portugal. Yeah. It was, what, South Korea, who they were hosts. Mm-hmm. They got a third place in that tournament.
Yep.
And then Poland, right? Was that the...
Poland. Poland beat the U.S.
Yeah, exactly. So that was a tough group. They get out. Mexico. And Mexico in a World Cup is a totally different beast.
Yep.
I mean, that was an amazing game.
I believe Mexico won their group that year, too.
Yeah.
So they were...
That was the Landon header. I remember Landon's header, far post. I mean, that
was
game
the first. Dos a cero.
I mean, a handball. Torsten Frings, I'm never going to forgive you. He admitted after the game, by the way, Torsten Frings, he said that they were lucky to win that game. U.S. toe-to-toe with Germany, one of the most consistent powerhouses in a World Cup. Mm-hmm. So that's the high water mark. I like so many things that Jurgen Klinsmann did. I give him credit. He was ambitious. He shook us. He shook us up. He made us ask ourselves a lot of questions, questions that needed to be asked. But at the end of the day, I think he overpromised and underdelivered. And that's not to say that it was a mistake. I think hiring him was the right thing. I think that we're better off because of that. We've learned a lot. Look how classy he is since he's left. He's wishing everyone good luck. He's still staying involved. So transition was the right one. We're on to Bruce. Under Bruce, what's happened? One very, very special thing. Christian Pulisic. I mean, the adjective is in the kid's name. Sick. This kid is sick. He's 18 years old. Producer Jorge.
Yep.
I'm just going to call you PJ because Producer Jorge is a lot. PJ, he's 18.
Yeah.
Does he look like he's 8? Well, he looks like he's 12.
Yeah.
Does he look like he's 18 out there?
No, I mean, he looks like... He's been playing in Europe for 10 years.
Holy cow. So I know I'm one of the ones that's scared about getting on the hype train and whatnot, but this is real. This kid's real. I called some guys in camp, asked them their thoughts on what we didn't see, and they were like, homeboy's real. This is the real thing. Obviously, you're playing Champions League with Borussia Dortmund. You're the real deal. But it could be a spike up. You know, it could be a little, just a moment of just finding the right form. But this isn't a fluke. This kid is going to be around for a very long time. And I immediately got a little bit sort of rubbed the wrong way because people were already comparing him to the Landon Donovan's career-wise and the Claudio Reyna's career-wise. And let's pump the brakes a little bit. Mm-hmm. As far as 18-year-olds go, best 18-year-old the U.S. has ever produced. I mean, Landon said it. Landon would probably be the one that you'd say was that. And Landon even said it on the broadcast in the Honduras game. This kid's a lot better than I was when I was 18. I played against Landon and with Landon when he was 18. Mm-hmm. Pulisic is better than Landon was when he was 18. But talent isn't everything in the arc of a career. This is one data point. This is a very early stage of his career, and a lot of it's circumstance. When Borussia Dortmund went to go scout him, they were scouting a different player. They weren't even looking for him, and they just noticed him. And granted, I mean, his performances were outstanding for the under 17s.
Well.
He was doing pretty well against Brazil in the Nike International Cup, where he had that incredible game. I think he was the MVP of that tournament. They notice him. They recognize him. He's on their radar. They bring him in, and credit to his family and to Christian Pulisic, because that's a big decision. You know, teenager, leaving your comfort zone to go over there. Landon will tell you, he tried to do it and couldn't cut it. Not because he wasn't good enough, because he just struggled. He was depressed. He was homesick, and it just didn't work out for him at Leverkusen. Then the next thing, you get there, you're performing well, you still need a little bit of luck. What happens is Marco Reus gets injured. That's his window to get into the starting lineup, and he performs when he gets that opportunity. And then the other thing, even before that, he needed a passport. And you know, he looked through his heritage. Well, he's got some Croatian background. He can get a passport. I mean, so many things had to sort of align to coincide with his talent and give him this opportunity. And the reason I say pump the brakes is guys like Claudio Reyna, guys like John O'Brien. You know, people forget John O'Brien was playing Champions League with Ajax at the San Siro against AC Milan. Was one of the best players on the field. People forget that Claudio Reyna, and most people don't know this. He's a good friend of mine, and he told me this story one day. When he was 20, he had the opportunity to. He was already playing with the U.S. team. He was at University of Virginia, and Johan Cruyff was the manager of Barcelona at the time, had his assistant approach Claudio's parents, because you don't have agents back then, at a tournament where he was playing with the U.S. and just crushing
it. Olympics, 92 Olympics probably.
Yeah.
Okay.
And says,
We want him to sign a Barcelona B contract, but we want him to train with the first team. So Claudio gets this, and of course, you're like, Johan Cruyff, I mean, an idol, one of the Dutch masters. This guy wants me to train with the first team.
Yeah.
And Claudio mulled it over and made what he'll admit one of the worst decisions of his life and said everything worked out pretty okay with Claudio, but said no because at that time, going off to Europe and playing with the B team and waiting for his opportunity with the first team, which is what Christian Pulisic did and got his opportunity, you're off the radar back then. 94 World Cup's coming up. He has the opportunity to play in a World Cup in his own country. And so he chose to go back to University of Virginia so he could be on the dashboard. He could be in the viewfinder of the national team coach so he could go to a World Cup. So he passed up an opportunity where he could have, who knows, Claudio. And this is why I took exception to people already throwing Pulisic into that category. Claudio was incredible. Yeah. I got into camp with him when I first got my first few caps, and that was at the end of Claudio's reign. This guy was so good. Just vision, composure, different, obviously much different type of player than Pulisic. But, like, I go down the list. I got, you know, fortunate enough to play with Landon for a long time. You know, Tab Ramos. Mm-hmm. We've had some incredible, incredible players, Clint Dempsey and Michael Bradley, who have done it for U.S., club and country, over a long stretch. You know, Christian Pulisic isn't close to that yet. But as far as 18-year-olds and as far as a data point in a career, this is as good as it gets. I mean, part of me is probably bitter that there's now another example of someone that was much better in the 10 jersey for the U.S. than I was. Much, much better, because I wasn't anywhere close to this kid when I was 18. Not even freaking close. But, like, you know, when I was younger, I was 20, and you know, I there were comparisons early on in my career to Claudio. I remember Eric Winald on a broadcast compared me to Tab Ramos. I was on the cover of Soccer America as, you know, the future. It was a generation, the next era with Carlos Bocanegra. But I wasn't good enough. I wasn't good enough to hold that up. I was a terrible pro. I started to find success, rookie of the year, getting in with the national team, and I wasn't disciplined enough. I was drinking a bunch. I was partying. I was having a fun time being a professional in Columbus, Ohio, one of only two professional teams there, so we actually got treated like big-timers, and took my eye off the prize, didn't eat well, making tombstone pizzas for myself every night, and then my legs gave out underneath me, and that was my fault. I wasn't good enough to realize my potential, and so in my mind, I was a failure because I was on an arc that I completely didn't keep up with. But I don't worry about that with this kid, because what I hear about him when guys talk about him is that he's humble, he's hardworking, and here's the quality that was in Landon, that was in Claudio. That's a very unique trait. He thrived in high-pressure situations, those guys. And we already see Christian Pulisic as an 18-year-old wanting the ball in big moments, wanting to – and by the way, the first 15 minutes in Panama and Honduras, he was giving the ball away.
He's getting pushed off the ball.
He was a bit sloppy. He was getting pushed off the ball. Panama was trying to foul him. But this kid's mental toughness, which kind of goes back to what Klinsmann's been harping this whole time, is that that's what happens with 18-year-olds over there. As you sink or swim at a much younger age, his mental toughness combined with his skill, combined with his athletic ability, combined with his ingenuity, his creativity, his je ne sais quoi. I mean, this kid is special, and I don't worry about overhyping him.
I mean, it probably helps, too, like we already talked about, that he plays for Borussia Dortmund, where he's not even really the best player on that team. And so he's not expected to be the star. Whereas with the U.S. team, like you're saying, right now he's getting a lot of hype, and that could add a lot of pressure. But when he goes back to Europe, he's probably back in Germany right now already training, that hype's gone now. That pressure's gone. Yeah. So that probably helps. I don't want to say keep him grounded, but it doesn't.
Totally.
It definitely doesn't
wear
on him.
I mean, that's what Landon never had. Landon was the face of U.S. soccer when there was no other star around him to take that pressure off him. I mean, listen, Clint Dempsey's still the star of the U.S. team right now. Mm. I mean, that was amazing. He came into camp, was not supposed to be a starter, was not fit enough to be a starter, stepped up. And
scary, too, with his health concerns.
And
I mean, just the fact to come back and play.
I think the heart thing, I was in the U.S. team with Clint. He was a punk, Clint, but in a great way. He's a street player. Mm-hmm. He's a chip on his shoulder. You know, go over the top of you in training if you're pissing him off.
He was
that type of player. Scrappy is a perfect word for him. And I used to butt heads with him so much because I was a pain in the ass too. And probably took exception that he was accelerating and gaining ground faster than I was and getting more opportunities than I was. But he was better than I was and was making strides. And I loved that he played with that chip on his shoulder. And I think, Jurgen, that was one of his miscalculations, was trying to give him the armband and turn him into something he's not. Mm-hmm. Clint didn't want that.
Yeah.
He even said, "I'm not a leader." But what I see in Clint right now, it kind of is commensurate with Zlatan Ibrahimovic, with like this renaissance of you just – if you only knew what you knew – now, when you were younger, the way he's taking care of himself, Zlatan Ibrahimovic. I mean, he's 35. He looks like he's 25. Clint's heart condition, where it was unclear whether or not he was going to be able to play again, I think has given him a new lease on life where his attitude is excellent. I was talking to guys, and they said he was communicating, leading, playing hard in training. He was there. And by the way, Bruce is going to bring him to the next World Cup for this reason, and this is going back to Klinsmann Bruce. This is one thing that Klinsmann made a big mistake about. Klinsmann feared the power of players, and no much more so with Landon Donovan, and kind of used him as a martyr and dangled this little carrot in front of him to bring him along right before the World Cup just so he could crush him in front of the players to use him as a point. Landon could have been a substitute in that tournament. By the way, in the Belgium game, if Landon comes on at the end of the game,
would have been a good option.
Wando, I love you, buddy, but I think Landon's putting that ball away. Clint's going to be that at this next World Cup.
Yeah.
He might not and probably won't be a starter. But going back to this new lease on life he has, I think he feels like he's been given a second chance, and he's taken it. He's taken it, and he's still good enough to be our number one goal scorer.
No, I don't disagree with that
so,
at all.
So it's looking good.
Yeah.
Well, am I getting a little bit too overexcited?
No. I don't think so. I mean,
it's early.
Like you said, well, we don't. There's the fear of the next Freddie Adu or someone like that. But like,
totally.
But we've already seen Pulisic. Like you said, he's playing in the Champions League for Dortmund. He's already doing things that players in the U.S. have never really done before.
Well, and Freddie never reached that. I mean,
exactly.
Freddie's height was a youth level height. So like Landon Golden Ball at the under 17 World Cup, I think it was, and I think Freddie got the same thing, right? Was that the under 17 World Cup, under 20 World Cup?
Yeah, I don't know.
I think it was the under 17 World Cup. I mean, what good are you for if you're not gonna look on your computer? You got a computer right there, PJ. That was youth tournaments totally different. I mean, go on the internet while you're listening, Tad Potter's out there, and look at Golden Boot winners for under 17, under 20 World Cups. There's gonna be a lot of names on that. You're gonna go who? And then there's going to be, like, the Cesc Fabregas and the ones who ended up panning out. So doing it at the youth level is one thing. Christian Pulisic is doing it for Borussia Dortmund in the friggin' Champions League. So let's go from just being excited about U.S. soccer.
Well, and before we move on, I don't know if you're ready to move on to our final topic.
I just want to do one
final to kind of close it all with Bruce and Pulisic is, first of all, one little bit of credit to Klinsmann is he was the first one to obviously bring in Pulisic.
Yeah.
So we don't know. I mean, Bruce probably, with him playing the Champions League, he probably would have brought him in if he'd been in charge of that.
And by the way, as a talent identifier,
Klinsmann gets credit for that.
And so, like, I just think if Klinsmann was – and Klinsmann and Bruce, by the way, get along. I don't know if they get along anymore, but they used to. When I was playing for the U.S. team Bruce used to invite Klinsmann to training sessions, and Klinsmann would play with us. He would throw on the U.S. kit and train with us. And by the way, that guy still had it. Holy cow, could he finish? And so in a, like, dream world, Jurgen Klinsmann as technical director and Bruce Arena as coach, I would have loved that because I'm hard on Klinsmann, but I like him a lot, and I think there are many wonderful qualities. If he's set up in the right scenario, like he was with Germany and Jogi Löw, if he's set up in the right scenario, then you can use the credit of him being a world-class player, his charisma, his ability to identify talent, all those things. So you're right. Good point. Christian Pulisic, I mean, he gets credit. That was his move to identify that, although I think Bruce would have had trouble picking that one out as Champions League when he's scoring against Real Madrid or setting up goals against Real Madrid. So, but U.S. soccer, I'm feeling good. I'm feeling good again.
So you brought up the key point with Bruce that seems like was the big difference in these most recent qualifiers was clarity, that the players knew exactly.
Clarity and simplifying the process.
Exactly.
I think Jurgen got a little bit too wrapped up in trying to create a club environment because a lot of players weren't in the type of club environment he wanted them to be in when international play isn't conducive to that. International play isn't club environment. I mean, you only have the guys for these tiny stretches, unless it's January camp, which isn't the guys that you're going to have at a World Cup, maybe two or three of them. So Bruce understands that it's a different beast. And also understands that he's got guys that went to college for 4 years. He's got guys that, you know, went through the Bradenton Academy system. He's got guys that have played now in the academies for clubs. He's got guys that have gone over here to Europe at a young age. He's dealt with the entire spectrum of American soccer mind. And I think Jurgen kind of struggled with and was frustrated with some of the... And it is shortcomings, some of the shortcomings and the difficulties and the handicaps because of our sports landscape.
Yeah. But, so just tying him back with Christian Pulisic is we obviously don't want to overhype him again and everything, but do you think when Bruce is figuring out what his best formation is, what his best lineup is, that he's going to build that lineup around Pulisic because he's clearly the most talented player?
Yes.
Or is he going to rely, like you brought up Dempsey, we obviously have Josie Alto, there's players like Bobby Wood, Fabian Johnson that have been injured, but so Pulisic
already
is the focal point already.
He did at Panama. Watch that Panama game back. There was a player who I don't think is going to be a part of the plan moving forward. Jermaine Jones, I think he's a bit past it. Obviously a very, very good player. He and Michael Bradley are not compatible. They're like our Frank Lampard and Steven Gerrard. I mean, they just don't work together. So go back and watch that game. And Christian Pulisic, instead of the first game we played top of the diamond, played off of the right. And Panama, when were we good? When he came in off the right and floated around. Watch who was always going to try to fill in that space to defend Jermaine Jones a little bit. He was having to try and shift and cover a lot of that ground.
Yep.
You know, Graham Susi's not really bombing forward. I mean, they had set up that system because, you know, an 18-year-old isn't floating around, really, I don't think, if he hasn't been given that license. Yeah, he's already doing it. He's already doing it in nearly must-win World Cup qualifiers. So, yeah, totally.
Great.
So going from something I feel really good about, and there's a lot of clarity, let's go to something that I do not feel confident about at all, where there is zero clarity and as muddled as you can possibly get. Arsene Wenger, stay or go? The decision. I mean, I want to see it LeBron James style. I mean, it's really building up that sort of dramatic status. Right before the international break, when pressure was at its highest, where I think the consensus was the greatest that it's time for Arsene Wenger to go. Two planes flying over, one saying, Arsene, we trust and love you, one saying, Arsene, see you later, buddy. What does he say after a terrible loss to West Brom? He says this.
I don't know. Don't worry. I will. I know what I will do in my future, so you will soon know, and very soon.
Okay. Not exactly sure what that means, and so everyone's thinking, okay, well, he's made up his mind. Very soon, right? Very soon is, what, a couple days? Okay, it's the international break. Wait, so probably when the international break is done, the first words we hear from Arsene Wenger is, okay, what's your decision? Let's hear it. Are you taking your talents to South Beach? What's happening? So we get here. We're back from international break. We're all getting amped up for the games, and Arsene Wenger takes to the mic and says this.
I'm very clear in my mind, but anyway, do I stay 2 months or 2 years? My commitment will be exactly the same. So the time I spent here that does not influence at all my attitude.
So we're still in suspense then, suggestions that there could be an announcement perhaps after the match?
I've always been very clear in my mind, you know, and I will remain like that, but I think it's a subject that at the moment, he's not sorted completely out.
Okay. Anyone confused out there? What is going on? So now we've gone from, okay, it seems like he's made a decision to, it's not sorted out yet. Am I going to stay 2 months? Am I going to stay 2 years? Somehow we're more confused than we were before the international break when he said very soon we would know the answer. I'm going to read between the lines because that's what we have to do with these press conferences. We see him every week, and Arsene Wenger's holding his cards close to the chest. I think he's staying. I think he's staying. I think that what's happening is there was a two-year contract on the table, right? And, Sir Chips Keswick, who no one knows this guy's name because he's one of the chairmen who never speaks, actually came out and said, it's a mutual decision if Arsene Wenger stays or not. It's us and him. We're going to make this decision. But everyone sort of scratched their heads and said, well, hold on. Isn't there a two-year contract on the table for him to stay? So then Arsene Wenger says, I've made my decision. So in our minds, it's did he say yes to a two-year contract and he's staying for two more years, or is he leaving? So when he says, I'm still clear in my head, but it's not exactly sorted out yet. What I see that, and if I'm going to decode that cryptic message, it's that one more year. He's going to stay one more year. So he's saying, give me one more year, and then we'll start to work on that exit strategy, the next plan after me, but give me a year to go forward. And I think that is a massive mistake.
So if he knows, though, if you're, like you're saying, that he knows that he's going to stay one more year, what is he waiting for? Why are we – he's told us that he's going to give us an answer soon, but he still hasn't. So
I have no idea. But I have no idea with Arsene Wenger anymore. And it seems like his players have no idea with Arsene Wenger anymore. And, I mean, listen, his players like him. This isn't a scenario like when Jose Mourinho lost his job recently or Claudio Ranieri lost his job where it was clear the players wanted a change. These players don't want to change, but that's the problem. They don't want to change because it's comfortable and easy and top four is good enough. No accountability. No one's really challenged. He doesn't criticize any of his players in public. He perpetuates this very soft environment. You hear this word mentality, and you want to know when you heard it recently that should scare you if you're an Arsenal fan? It was Alexis Sanchez that said, I want to stay in London, but I want to stay in London with a winning team that has a winning mentality. Arsenal do not have a winning mentality because of Arsene Wenger.
Well, and that's what I was going to say is, do you think I don't know if it's clear that every single Arsenal player is happy with him.
Well, no, Alexis is gone. I think he's gone. Okay. I don't think Alexis is sticking around for this because he knows that Arsene Wenger is bigger than everyone else. I mean, this guy's the last samurai. No one else exists in the soccer world that has the power, the longevity, the security that Arsene Wenger has. I mean, the last one was Sir Alex Ferguson, but Sir Alex Ferguson had titles. That was why you could stick around in a modern game where things tend to get stale. Look at the turnover with really successful managers. The Antonio Conte's, the Claudio Ranieri just leaving, Jose Mourinho. Pep Guardiola, guys don't stick around very long because players are coming in and out. In the modern game, the locker room's new every single season. And guys kind of tire of the old same message and need something fresh. And listen, get as mad as you want about the modern game. Be pissed off that it's not as romantic and loyalty's dead. You can be pissed off, but you have to be realistic that that's the way that things are now. So Arsene Wenger, there isn't a winning way at Arsenal. There's a Wenger way at Arsenal. And the Arsene Wenger way is, and I defended him for a long time because when he transitioned from Highbury to Emirates, took on big debt. That was a big project, and he was fiscally responsible and said, listen, I'm not going to just throw a bunch of debt on this team. I'm going to try to find value, which he's always been pretty good at, which is more and more difficult these days in the current player market, but was conservative. And everyone understood, and they accepted that. But everyone gave up on the glory and the titles that were won in Highbury for promises of European knights lifting trophies, for promises of world-class players that you had to overpay for. The fact that that's not happening, when Arsene Wenger and Ivan Gazidis and Arsenal are bragging about 200, 300 million pound war chest to go and spend, Arsenal fans are furious. Players are furious because they don't see within the group, the Mesut Ozils, the Alexis Sanchez's, guys that have come from winning locker rooms, they don't see a winning locker room. And they just took a big leap of faith because typically it's an exodus. It's Samir Nasri, it's Cesc Fabregas leaving to go win titles. Finally, they started to attract world-class players to start to win titles again. And everyone's kind of feeling a little bit like they sold bill of goods. Here's the problem if he says, I'm going to stay another year. Now, all of a sudden, these players I think a year is too long for them to feel motivated to deliver something for Arsene Wenger. Right now is the time to deliver for Arsene Wenger. You say this is his last season. I promise you, you see an uptick in effort and performance from this side. They finish in top four, and everyone claps, carries Arsene Wenger out of there, give him a statue, give him a stand, and hug the guy and protect the legacy. If he stays an extra year, it's going to get stale. They're going to miss out on top four, and if it's another year, they're going to miss out on top four two seasons in a row for me. And now all of a sudden, you're going to struggle with player recruitment. That summer is going to be difficult because now you're dealing with, did they announce a manager halfway through the season like they did with Pellegrini and Pep Guardiola? Because that undercut Pellegrini, and they struggled heavily when they made that move. So you have to understand, when you're a player and you go to a training site, your relationship with your manager, and I kind of touched on this earlier, it's this weird, like, he's like kind of like a celebrity walking around the hallways. You catch glimpses of him. But a lot of managers aren't really, really hands-on where you see them a lot. He has this sort of his minders and his handlers, like the assistants, that will come and be the sort of conduit to give you all the communication, to be your buddy, to be the one that you talk to be the your sort of go-through to get to the manager. And the manager gives you really important conversations, informations, and interactions when it's necessary. What I've heard from people that play for Arsene Wenger is he doesn't communicate with the guys. He's not a after-the-game, halftime, pre-game talker. He's not a big, if you're not starting this weekend, this is why guy. And so I think the lack of leaders in the team, the Saul Campbells, the Tony Adams, the Patrick Vieiras, the guys we've talked about all these years, no one's really doing it. Steve Bould's not doing it. No one's having these valuable, integral conversations week in and week out with players to either arrest their mediocrity and let them know it's not good enough, or communicate to them and help them understand what's going on. Like the Oxlade-Chamberlains, the Walcotts, and the Iwobis, and some of these younger guys that I think are honestly starting to consider options outside of Arsenal because they'll go through a few games not being in the team, and no one will kind of tell them why. So I just think there's something expired there with Arsene Wenger, and he should go while he's still beloved, and he will always be, of course. But right now, I think there's still so much credit for what he's done, which has completely revolutionized the Premier League and Arsenal, make them a better place, but he's starting to outstay his welcome.
Well, I mean, like you said, if he were to announce today that he was going to leave, the whole narrative would change for the rest of the season. In terms of, you brought up the players, will probably kind of pick up, just like how Leicester have since Ranieri got there. Maybe a sort of different way, obviously. But the way the media, though, too, the narrative will change in how the media will start to cover him, because I think they'll start to
look back.
They'll look back at those how he the first half of his career when he's winning Premier League titles and playing some of the best
it will be
soccer that we've seen in England.
It will be a 2-month-long guard of honor.
Yeah,
it will.
Exactly.
It will be. It will
would
be
you think he wouldn't want to enjoy? He would want. That's the way he would want to go out.
But here's the thing. I think one of the reasons he needs to go and the decision needs to be taken away from him is he doesn't see all of this. He's so in love with this club, and he believes with every fiber of his being that he's good for it, and that he can push it that little bit further. In the last few seasons, they've been so close. I mean, honestly, they're an ingredient off. But unfortunately, that ingredient is clear now. The constant in every failed title challenge over the past decade is a weak mentality perpetuated by Arsene Wenger. And so instead of having podcasts devoted to this, you're right, podcasts should be devoted to celebrating how important he's been to the game, to the Premier League, to Arsenal. And that's what would happen tomorrow if he announced he was leaving. It would show that he loves that would truly show how much he loves Arsenal. That through sort of tearful eyes, he would admit that they're no longer in love with each other. They're no longer right for each other. And maybe it happens before this pod even comes out, guys. And if it does, then, well, Arsene, we love you. But something's got to give.
Well, just one, I guess, last kind of question about it is, if he's not going to be the one that makes the decision, like, It always seems it's going to come down to him. The board is not going to make this decision and say, we're moving on and not offer him that contract. What is the reason that it's holding them up? Is it the fact that they have had this consistency, like you said, they're making money every single year?
Yeah.
And you look at some of the other top clubs who have sacked their managers, or the managers have left. Man United has only been in the top four once since Fergie left. Chelsea didn't make it last year. Maybe that's a slightly different one. But Liverpool obviously been in and out, and Spurs the same thing. So is there a fear? Arsenal's the only one who's been the constant.
Yeah.
Is there that fear that they'll become like one of those clubs where they're not sure? And is that what's told
me? PJ, great question. Yes. Here's the thing. Arsene is great for business. Stan Kroenke's a businessman, okay? They run a very successful business. I mean, they have profits that are coming in that are incredible for a team that doesn't win titles. I mean, Manchester United, obviously a much bigger business, but it's because people want to sign up with winners. And yes, they're scared that, and there's a chance that a new coach won't deliver that consistency. They don't like risk, and Arsene Wenger is a very risk calculated move. I mean, that is a risk averse move to keep him in charge. That should confidently, because his top four consistency is remarkable. There is a chance that it doesn't work with a new manager and you lose that consistency, but there's also a chance it works and you start to win titles, which this club needs. The difference with Manchester United is Manchester United left and the expectations were to win titles. That's not the expectation of Arsenal right now. And here's the other thing. Sir Alex Ferguson left a team that had expired. That team that he won the title with overachieved big time. And David Moyes inherited a team that needed a lot of help. And they've been trying to give help to this side ever since. And so I understand why the owners, the board, are hesitant to say goodbye to Arsene Wenger. I get it. But I think the fans, for the first time, listen, there are some that want him to stay, of course. There are players that want him to stay. But I think for the first time, the consensus is larger that people want Arsene Wenger to say goodbye. They want it to be a love fest, and they want to move on and start a new era. That's it. So how do we do? I mean, the goal was 30 minutes, 10 minutes over, which I think is good for a first pod. You could see the problem is that once I get going, I can't stop. But
like Arsene Wenger, we might have.
I never went to say no. I never know when to move on. It's clear in my mind, but I just can't make that decision. But Tad Potters, this is going to be fun. We're going to have a good time doing this. So what I need you to do is subscribe. You got to rate this show because that bumps us up so other people can listen to it. Other people can catch it. Also, hit me up on Twitter, at Kyle Martino. Make fun of me. Talk about my hair. Agree with me. Disagree with me. Come up with topics that you think we should discuss on the next pod. Do it all. But make sure you keep listening. Keep striving. Keep loving the game. And Tad Potters, do me a favor. Always stay on your feet.